Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Context. We are a dramaturgy podcast of everything awesome. And today with me, I'm very excited to have Jenna Rogers from Chromatic Theater in Canada, Alberta, Canada. And she has a project she's very excited about that I, therefore, am also very excited about. And she does work that I think is really interesting. And you'll also notice that so far, she's the only like legitimate theater person that we've had on the show. But I work with Jenna at the Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas. In fact, so many of the people that we've talked to have been part of that dramaturgy community. But they're working, you know, in museums or in burlesque or in magic or in some theatrical non-theater capacity. So I am very excited to be with Jenna today to have a little bit of a grounding moment so we could talk about actual theater, but also because she is doing theatrical things in innovative ways. And with that, welcome, Jenna. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
So can you tell me about the work that you do at Chromatic?
Chromatic Theater is a company that, like, I don't know, started in my brain in 2013 and then incorporated in the world in, like, I should know this better. 2016 officially.
Oh, wow. You guys are new.
Yeah, we're infants. We're we're toddlers technically.
The website looks like you're such mature professionals. So I just assume that you've been here since time immemorial.
Well, thank you. Maybe it has to do with our website services looking old.
No, it's high quality. It's like, hello, we're adults who know what we're doing. We know how to behave in the world. We've been here since longer than 2016.
I love it. And we're mandated, or the goal is to develop and create work by and for culturally diverse artists. You can't tell it by my name in podcast land, but I am a mixed race artist. And a lot of my artistic career has been about trying to carve out space or conversation or finding narratives and collisions and like really trying to find a way to push forward people from marginalized communities. And so I started Chromatic Theater to be a platform to do that work. And I'm trying to grow it so that like if when I'm ready to like move on, that it's got a solid foundation for someone else to like take forward. And because I think the work needs to continue. It's not like a thing that we can be like, check, we finished.
And I did it. I solved racism. Yay. Yeah. That's great. I do actually want to dwell on that piece of information for a minute, just because it is so foundational. And you're right, people who are in podcast land who are probably seeing the description, like Jenna Rogers is a very Anglican sounding name. Do you find that as you're trying to do this kind of work, does the disparity between the way your name comes off to people and the way your appearance potentially comes off to people create barriers for you in the work that you want to get done, or opportunities?
Oh, for sure. Like I could talk for 100 years about how I feel about my name. it's hard. I don't know that it's necessarily about barriers or opportunities. Like I think sometimes there's hesitation because people don't know what to expect or don't know why, like maybe this white lady is coming in to do this work. And then they see me and they're like, oh, because they do a lot of like work as I try to do a lot of work in anti-racism initiatives and facilitation. So the perception is important, and like it's like, and then I've also run into challenges where like my bio, like the standard bio that theater artists put in the back of programs or whatever, mine starts with like Jenna Rogers is a mixed race theater artist, da, 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 da. And I've had theaters question me being like, I think that this is kind of racist, and I'm like, what do you mean? And
go deeper.
And they're like, well, it sounds weird that we're starting your bio with a description of your race when we don't address anyone else's race at the beginning of your bio. And I'm like, well, one, that's my choice. And two, I always feel compelled to, because it's the first question, as I think so many mixed race people out there will relate to this experience. It's one of the first questions people ask you. And we're like, just get over it.
Oh, really? Like, what is the question? Like a
What
what
are
are
you?
you? Yeah.
Yeah, what are you? Where are you from? No, where are you really from? Where are your parents from?
Cool,
Like
cool.
they just need to know. And
Well,
I
Calgary.
I live in the world of ambiguity. Like
Yeah.
I don't look white, but it's really hard for people to guess what my ethnic background is, which I'm happy to say publicly. I just am usually like, get to know me first.
Yeah.
But I'm Chinese and Welsh.
Okay.
But in Canada, I can be mistaken for lots of things, and probably elsewhere.
Okay, that's really interesting. Just, in terms of thinking about intersectionality for not just theater artists, but for all of us, and something that people can't tell in podcast land for me as well is that I am disabled and I walk with a cane. I have a pain disorder, and that does inform how I navigate theater and how I navigate the world. But I also do sort of come off in a lot of ways as non-disabled. To the extent that I've had other even like good friends and theater practitioners, kind of come to me for like advice on the disability community. One person in particular phrased it like, "Well, you're not like one of the scary disabled people." You know what I mean? And so it's like I find myself in this because if I didn't have a cane, if I wasn't walking with a cane, you wouldn't necessarily look at me. I don't think that I'd have a tell apart from just being kind of off balance when I walk. You wouldn't think, oh, there's a disabled woman. And so I do find that I'm often the bridge between a disabled audience and a non-disabled theater administrator, for example, or like, I find myself in like an ambassador position, whereas, I only have this one disability experience of I know what it's like to have a pain disorder, be pretty tired, and walk with a cane. Like, okay, so great. Can you tell me how cerebral palsy is gonna affect a audience, like how that affects audience members who are seeing this particular show? I'm like, I can do my best. So all that to say, I'm glad that you brought it up. I'm glad that we're addressing it because I think intersectionality with all of our identity markers I mean, for me, it really informs the work I do, and I know it informs the work you do because it's the first thing in your bio. And I do struggle with sometimes that when I'm applying for work, when it's relevant, like do I mean, and it's also like an a protected status. So when I'm applying for a job, do I say, "Hi, I'm disabled. I'm a disabled lady. Maybe hire me, maybe don't, but definitely take this thing that you're legally not allowed to consider into consideration." At least that's the case in the United States. And here are all of my identity markers. Please consider them in hiring me.
Well, in an industry like in the arts, it's actually it's like not legal to ask, but like we also kind of have to say, or we also kind of get known for that kind of work, which is true.
Right. Yeah.
And I think while we're talking about intersectionality, it's important to shout out, I think Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, who is the African American professor who coined the term, and to just acknowledge the work
Yeah.
that she did and in bringing that work out there. And when I think about intersectionality, I often think about reciprocity. Like I think I agree, I find myself in liminal space all the time as like a bridge between two groups trying to have to translate from both sides. But we also know that translation or interpretation is an imperfect art, and one lived experience cannot possibly be representative of hundreds or thousands. And so that's to me where the reciprocity comes in. I go, yeah, I believe part of my service as an artist is to be a bridge, but because I think theater is an incredible, powerful tool to transpose an experience, live, like a live experience to another, to an audience or to receivers to go through something together. But I also think that there's a degree of reciprocity that like the people that you're talking to, whether it's an audience or whether it's another administrator, has to actually want a plurality of perspectives,
Yeah.
has to crave, has to understand that you're only translating one thing or interpreting one thing for them, and that it's a piece of a larger puzzle that they must continue to do the work that is ongoing. Yeah, which is why I'm always like, it's just not, none of this stuff, is a box. can just take off and be done. It's the work is ongoing, and frankly, if we're doing it right, it won't ever be finished. Because we'll keep learning and growing as people, as a society, as a culture, and the conversation will just shift. Will just shift.
You know, you said something to me yesterday when we did our test call, that I really liked and wanted to make sure to try to prod you into saying again today, but I'll just tell the audience what it was. You're
Okay.
saying something about how as dramaturgs, a big part of our job is just to be, instead of finding answers, we have to be satisfied knowing that we've asked the right questions. Did I represent that quote right?
Yeah, something along those lines that like that part of art making and like what I love and is vital about being a dramaturg is finding satisfaction living in questions. And so maybe another like nice way to say it is like for me, I seek to make art not for answers, but for questions.
I dig it. So chromatic, you aim to bring a diversity of voices, a plurality of perspectives, to bring to the forefront stories from and about marginalized communities. Correct me if I get any of the language wrong on that, because I'm interpreting and representing to make sure that I have my understanding correct and to make sure that I'm presenting it to our audience, right? Cool. So you're not coming in as the theater that is the viewpoint of Canadian women of mixed Chinese and Welsh descent and telling that story or speaking on behalf of every Welsh person, every Asian person, every woman, every lady with glasses. So I want to move on, try to bridge that into the project that you're working on now. You're doing an adaptation of Winners and Losers. Can you tell me about that project and how it fits into the mission? Three-part question. What's that project? How does it fit into the mission? And a third thing that I just forgot. Yeah, we'll start with those two.
That's great. Perfect. Okay, so that project, Winners and Losers. Winners and Losers is a play that was written by Marcus Youssef and James Long, who are both talented theater artists and friends who are based in Vancouver, which is in British Columbia in Canada. I think everyone knows. I think most American audiences would know where Vancouver is. And they wrote it a few years ago. I can't remember the year, but it's toured widely. It has been in American cities. I know it was in I know for sure that it was in Seattle, and is on the it's it, you can stream it online on the boards.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I think it's
what?
like $5 or something. You can watch
Okay,
it.
tell if pause, tell us about On the Boards. That sounds like a really good resource for our
Oh
podcast
God.
audience and
Great.
for, I mean, to the extent that you can. On the
I'm like,
Boards.
you might know more about On the Boards than I
No, I
do.
don't know anything. What I don't know could fill a warehouse. That's why I interview smart people.
Great. Let me simultaneously Google this because I want to make sure it's called On the
Oh,
Boards. But
sure.
it's a Seattle-based company,
It's
maybe.
yes, it's ringing bells. It's yes. Now that you're saying it, I can confirm
And
yes.
they bring in they I believe they do quite a bit of touring. They bring in shows from across the country and globally, internationally, and they record them. And they are like pretty cool, yes, performing arts theater in Seattle, Washington. And they record them and make them available for a small fee online. So if you are, in the Midwest and you don't have a major regional theater in your area, but you wanted to see something really cool, you can invite your friends over and pay $5 to watch it and like eat popcorn. And it's a cool viewing experience.
Holy cow, I love everything about that. Okay, thank you. So then my next thing, I had a friend who had moved who I knew from the DC theater scene who moved to Seattle almost as soon as she got there, say, because I was looking for my next job. Say, if you're looking at Seattle at all, you should look at On the Boards. They do great stuff. And all I did was go to their website and see jobs available. I'm like, ah, no, this the they are not for me. I do not care for their stylings based on the jobs that they can offer me at this time. But that did that is so now that's the second time that someone has brought up On the Boards as a thing to look at. So we want to gonna look into it a little further and see if they want to come tell us about all the cool things they do on a future episode.
Yeah, and like I don't actually know much about them other than like literally when I first wanted to do this because I knew Jamie and Marcus as friends, and I was interested in this idea. I went to On the Boards and like I literally invited some friends over and we made popcorn and we watched the show together.
My gosh.
I didn't feel like I was watching it alone.
I love everything about that. I really do. Like part of what brought me, so I'm in Los Angeles right now. Part of what mm-hmm. brought me from Washington, D.C. back to my home in L.A. Was to get into film and television. Like I got an MFA, not in playwriting, but in creative writing at a trade school at Full Sail University in Orlando that was geared towards like popular entertainment, like broadcast, because I had started to feel like, you know, some of the best stories were coming on television. But the main thing was the accessibility of, you know, for reasons of geography, reasons of physical ability, people not being able to like get into a theater and like sit on their couch with their snacks, with their friends and be able to like talk and react to stuff in real time. It was making it feel to me, and this was, you know, now 4 years ago, it was making it feel to me like theater wasn't doing enough to create space for audiences who wanted to be engaged in culture the way they wanted to be engaged in culture. And on the Board sounds like a really good tool. I like the popcorn part. I like that you could be in your pajamas. But at the end of the day, there is something really that you can't beat or match about live performance, but I'm constantly trying to find the ways to beat or match it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's not, I know it's, but they have a setup there so that there is a method to recording it. And so you can see it and it looks really good. But of course, live performance is different from recorded performance. Like I could still pause, which you can't do in a live performance. And there's a magic to that, but there's, it's definitely a cool thing worth checking out. I've been meaning to go back there to watch another performance that I've wanted to see because they have a lot of work that comes in and out that's international, which is cool. And being from the DC area, I know that Winners and Losers, the original, also was with, I think it went to Woolly Mammoth.
I think it did too. That sounds very familiar. I'm going to 90% confirm that.
Great. Yeah. So it's been around. And the premise of the show is that these two men sit down to play a made up game. In which they argue over whether people, places, or things are winners or losers.
That's right. This definitely went to Woolly Mammoth.
Yeah. Did you see it?
No, I didn't. I read a lot about it.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of show that makes people talk. And things that are maybe important to know about the original is that Jamie James is a white guy. Marcus is Egyptian. He's a brown guy. And their play ended up largely being about, not to like spoiler alert, but ended up being a lot about class. I don't think they're touring it as much anymore. So I think it's okay. Their play ended up being a lot about class and the different classes and class structures and systems they worked into. And as they continued to play the game, it started to reveal the sort of deep-seated beliefs they had around class and what's important and how you like raise a family and things like that. So, that was their exploration. I talked to them. They gave me permission. It helps that we're friends, but they gave me permission to adapt it. And I wanted to adapt it across gender with two women. And I think that the script feels really improvised. And so the tricky thing here, it's not like we were picking up their script and reading it because it was really about them. It was about their lives. So we couldn't just be like, just like change the pronouns and be like, here we go. because we don't come with that set of beliefs. And like the idea of two men sitting at a table arguing about things is appealing to some people and super unappealing to other people. I mean, we do hear men argue a lot in society and that's like basically politics.
So it sounds like there's a big difference between this adaptation that you did versus a cross-gendered casting. Like, it's not like you took Hamlet and then swapped all the roles. It's like you had to write a new play off of this existing work that followed, you know, an adaptation that followed closely the outline and the permission structures that were given to you by the original playwrights. Is that accurate?
Yeah, you totally nailed it. And so we had to find ways to, I don't know, assemble a creative team and yeah, adapt the work. And what we have now, which we're like we're done, not done. We're hoping to still make a few changes. We just finished a run in Toronto at part of the Summer Works Festival, and we're hoping to make a couple more changes, but we're running in Calgary in November, and then hoping to kind of put it on tour, see if people will bite, and even theaters that have hosted a version of the work before, if they wanted to do another version. And though there's an interesting politic of that, right? Like if you have the boys come through, are you going to have the girls come through? Are you going to put the girls in the second space, or are you just not going to have the girls at all? Like what's the politic of that?
Yeah. Ooh, rotating nights, is that a thing? I don't know.
Yeah, it already makes things complicated, and like it's easy because they're finished touring as far as I know. I think they'd have to have a pretty like lucrative time space offer. But like even asking those questions starts to get hard. Like if you've brought the show through with men, would you bring the show through with women again? Why not? Or why?
Right. And is the, and there sounds like there's probably, apart from your theater, it seems unlikely that someone would produce, well, tell, it strikes me as unlikely that a theater would produce just the adaptation with just women. Does that strike you as true as well?
No, I think they might. I guess the question is, maybe I have to talk about what the adaptation process looked like,
Yeah,
because I think
tell
that's
me.
an interesting dramaturgy process. But to answer that question, I think that no, I think a theater company might. I think a company that maybe couldn't get the original out would want, like, this would still satisfy an interest or a need that they have. And I think it would also be interesting for a company that had the original to continue the dialogue with the new adaptation. But I don't think, I think they live, they exist as totally separate pieces of work. They could be in conversation with each other, but they don't have to be.
And
So, oh, go ahead.
I was going to ask, did so you did the you rewrote it for two women. Did you keep the Egyptian descent and the white European descent the same or as identity markers, or was that flipped too?
That's flipped as well.
Okay.
So what happened was we, so to adapt the script, because it is highly personal, it's very clear that these two actors are telling about their lives, or at least part of their lives, or at least a somewhat fictionalized part of their lives, maybe. I had to find two artists who, which was a unique ask as a producer, to be like, hey, do you want to be in a project? We have development money, and like, we're gonna go, so it could span a couple years, a couple good paychecks, but like actually put your life on stage, which is a stressful thing already. But I found a couple of performers. Actually, ended up losing one partway through the process and having to replace them with a different performer.
Was that because of anything in the script or for unrelated reasons?
Probably, well, maybe like maybe a combo of both. Though I think more unrelated, like I think there has to be a sort of central tension point in the text. And with, like I said, the two gents, their play, the text starts to center in around class. And I think the person that we had felt like she was actually too similar to the performer
Okay, that's really interesting.
and was having a hard time finding conflict that wasn't contrived and felt comfortable kind of just stepping away from the
Oh,
task.
that's really, I mean, without, I don't want to get into like what's potentially like a personnel issue too deeply, but I do like and respect that an actor, producer, performer is able to sort of identify with you where the tension point wasn't existing and able to volunteer stepping away for the sake of somebody else who might be able to serve the story better.
Yeah, I think it was a super brave choice, and like we're friends. Like she's in fact like a very dear friend to my heart, and
Oh,
so
good.
I think there was a really tricky question in terms of like creating new work. And we talk a lot about like decolonizing process and what that might look like. And I think that I've been having a lot of reflection on there is a unique challenge to being like the director producer of a work and dramaturg, but essentially like the creative lead. Like I'm writing the paychecks or whatever. But because the ask is so big, like to put your life on stage, it was really important to me that I actually made sure those artists had agency in the room all the time, which walks a funny line between sometimes them being like, Jenna, tell us what to do.
Right.
And me being like,
tell your truth.
Yeah. And me being like, I can't tell you what to do because you have to consent to the content that comes out of your mouth. Like, you know, that. And there were lots of agreements. We worked on lots of things in space that allowed them agency over the words that were ultimately performed. But maybe what I should tell you is that, so what we did, what we ultimately did process-wise, is we took the script, the original script, and the play that the performers always say it's about 80% scripted. There's a little loose to the script. There are some sections that are like, tell us a thing to talk about, audience, and the audience does. So it's about 80% scripted. So we took that script and we broke it down into beats, not like acting beats, but dramaturgical beats, where the driving question was like, what is the function? Oh no, can you hear noise in the background?
I can. Hey, you know what? I don't think that we are going to have commercials yet, but let's use this opportunity to take a quick break and I'm going to make up a sponsor in between. Okay. And then you could put on some headphones because Jenna's calling us from a working theater and there's a production meeting on the other side of the wall. So we're going to switch audio. We'll be right back.
Get a little closer.
Closer.
Now don't be shy.
Closer.
You can get a little closer.
Closer.
With Arid Extra Dry.
Only Arid has a patent on this formula that fights wetness. No leading deodorant spray stops odor better. And now Arid has a new baby fresh scent. It smells,
Get a little closer.
Closer.
With the baby fresh scent of Arid Extra Dry.
Arid fights wetness and odor. Now in a new baby fresh scent.
And we're back, and Jenna is still here with us, and hopefully hasn't too much lost her train of thought, and she's got in new fancy headphones. So Jenna, you were telling us winners and losers, the difficulty of basically producing someone else's story and making them be able to consent to revealing the truths of their heart and trying to walk them through that process while you are the one who's the director and producer, as opposed to like a one-woman show where someone decides, I'm going to tell this story that's very important to me, and that tension.
Yeah. So I will get there. I will circle all the way back.
Yeah.
So essentially in process, we broke the script down into kind of dramaturgical function. So the reality was, it's not acting beats. It wasn't like, because it would be like this section, they talk about coffee makers. That wasn't important. But what was important to see was like why they were talking about coffee makers. And like maybe it set up an essential seed about class that like one person's argument was essentially like, you don't like coffee makers because you want to go out and purchase your coffee every day, but not everyone can afford to do that. And that's why there's a loser. So it's like a tiny seed about class or something like that, which is inconsequential because most people don't have like deep, like moral issues around whether or not coffee makers are winners or losers. Right. But the function of that scene then might be to like plant a seed that then pays off way later in the play. So we were paying really close attention to that. It meant we really, really mined the transitions to understand like how we were going on this emotional ride, and we made a giant post-it wall of like all of what we thought the functions were of the play.
I love post-its on a wall. Can I I don't want to get you off track, but I also want to dive down every single rabbit hole. Do you usually use dramaturgical beats as part of your process for a regular scripted show? Is that part of your toolkit as a dramaturg?
No, not necessarily. I think it's part of my toolkit as a dramaturg, but I do think that as an artist, I keep my dramaturg hat and my directing hat in like separate closets sometimes. Mm-hmm. Because when I'm dramaturging, I'm really focused on like understanding the ways things work and what the playwrights are trying to do and how to open all the potential doors. And as a director, I'm really trying to follow one path to production. And I don't really work as a production dramaturg, so I don't really know what that's like.
You know, and I really don't either, that's so interesting. I look at it as, facilitating meaning making, At least when I was doing dramaturgy before I ever knew that that's what I was doing, before I knew that that's what it was called, I would describe my work as, well, I facilitate meaning making between the art and the audience, or, you know, as needed between the playwrights and actors, or, you know, facilitate meaning making with the stakeholders, if only there were a word for that. But very little of it was ever done in a rehearsal hall. It was always back end, front end. Not during. Okay, sorry, I did not want to get you off track.
No, it's okay. So what we would then do is then we did a lot of improvisation, where we would have topics and we would pick topics that we thought served the function. So if the function was to complicate the idea of winners and losers, which is basically a section in which we demonstrate, this is so nerdy, it's a section in which we demonstrate that winning isn't necessarily something we like. Winning is defined by the context, the cultural context in which we live, or the whatever. And in our production, I'll give it away. It's a tiny section. This is like a half a page. We talk about Russia, mm-hmm. and someone says Russia's a winner. Someone says Russia's a loser. And then one person says, they just had the World Cup and everyone was ignoring all the human rights issues and all of the was totally fine with all the problematic issues of that. And the other person goes, yeah, that's exactly why they're losers. And there's also the whole deal with Ukraine, mm-hmm. and how much power they hold right now. And the other person goes, yeah, their leader does whatever they want, and they kind of get away with it. So doesn't that make them a winner?
So it's not necessarily that you are a winner because you have power. You could also be a loser because you're using your power poorly.
Yeah. So you could be, and it's a little bit like how things are. It's also about how we as humans choose arguments that serve us. They're not always about winning and losing is a binary, but binaries don't hold up very long. It's really easy to say, Russia's a loser because they're mean and they don't have,
right.
because they're mean and because of human rights violations and because queer people are still fleeing that country because they can't live with basic human rights. Mm-hmm. But it's also easy to say, well, they're a winner because they're getting away with it. They're still at the biggest table at the UN. They're still mm-hmm. part of the G8. They still are included in all of the major conversations and no one is stopping them. So they're winning.
Yeah. Yep. I don't have a good answer on whether they are winners or losers, but I could see a good case for both.
Yeah. And you can flip it both ways. Mm-hmm. I could make a different argument as to why they're winners. They're a different argument to why they're losers, but we've kind of been really intentional based on those dramaturgical functions about what we're trying to do. Because up until that point in the play, generally speaking, winning or losing has been pretty much about, it's not been about the moral standpoint that someone takes, and it's not been about capitalism, which kind of that argument is about capitalism to some extent. It's been more like camping is a winner because you get to hang out in nature and it's beautiful outside. And then camping is a loser because I like my bed. That's been the kind of depth-ish of the argument.
So how did it change having two women who were not the original writers and producers of it in this process?
Well, I think to me, there's lots of things that I go, women fight differently.
Yeah.
There's a section in the original, which we deemed a dramaturgical function to break up the sitting at a table. So it's a physical action where they wrestle one another. They move mm-hmm. the table and they do Greco-Roman wrestling.
Oh yeah. That's not how I've had disputes with my lady friends.
No. And also putting two women in the public eye wrestling each other on the floor is really different from putting two men in the public eye wrestling each other on the floor.
There is a different gaze going on.
Totally, in terms of what we consume and what our culture sadly has been trained to do. And so, we were we understand that the function of this needs to be a physical break. We can't just watch two people sit at a table for, 75 minutes. Mm-hmm. So what's a physical thing that women can do that is a competition that... and it ended up being for us a kind of choreography contest.
Nice. I would have, my thought was immediately went to, well, if there were stagehands who could participate, it's a double Dutch contest.
Yeah, yeah.
out on the schoolyard, some kind of four square jump roping, hair braiding.
It's like a dance fest. So it's one of the actors teaches the other actor some dance steps, and then they try to perform it while continuing their arguments.
Oh, I like that. I mean, it sounds like it definitely would be a break in the action and keep that good up-temponess of a Greco-Roman wrestling match, which you obviously couldn't do without changing the tone a little bit. Very cool.
So yeah, like it changed a great deal. And like the bodies of the people on stage, we're doing it with a first gen Black artist who was born in Zambia, and a many generation white passing Indigenous woman, who is, and one artist, the Black artist is in her 20s, and the white passing artist is in her late 50s. Mm-hmm. So there's a race thing that happens just on seeing, mm-hmm. and there's an age thing that happens just on seeing. And we all know also that like women and age is complicated, and especially in our theater industry.
Right. No kidding.
So there's a sort of intergenerational dialogue going on, which taking in front of audiences in Toronto, like we knew that was a thing, but it was like, it's really a thing.
Yeah. What did you experience by taking it in front of audiences?
We had assumptions about like who would side with who and why they would side with them. And we weren't necessarily right on all of them. but it was like, oh, there is, maybe because I feel sometimes like I'm a little bit in between generations, but that's not necessarily true. Like technically by my birth order, I'm solidly in the like millennial category. But I was surprised at the audience's desire to pick sides.
Oh, really?
I mean, that's the point, but it was also like, the easiest way to like lose an audience of people over 40 is basically to be like, your ideas are outdated. Yeah. And so we were like, oh, like that's the way we talk to one another all the time. But like, we didn't realize like the ripple effect or the audience, how seriously the audience would take that. Cause we do talk about that all the time when you're criticizing each other's ideas, but like how personally people make that about age and aging and, mm-hmm. Forgetting, for me, it's also been a little bit of a learning process about like millennials are so often by like the media and the powers that be being dismissed as being like young and irresponsible. But the reality is that most of us are in our late 20s and in our 30s now. And we're a huge generation. Like there's lots of us. And it's the first time I've started to piece together that like maybe part of the reason that we get dismissed by some of like the bigger, maybe even right-leaning, maybe not right-leaning, but like big conglomerates is because we're threatening.
Ooh, I like that. I mean, I don't
and
like
so we threaten threats, that.
But
no.
Like, I like the idea that I could be perceived as threatening.
Yeah. So well, and that it's threatening it. Back when we go, that's not relevant anymore.
Or, yeah.
And in fact, it is like, I think some of the moments that the younger artists employs that tactic are more effective than others. Cause some of those moments you're like, oh, that isn't relevant. And some of those are like, that's just a shitty argument.
That's just a cheap shot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
So you just finished this show in Toronto and you're going to be doing it at your theater in Calgary. When does that happen? That's coming up, right?
Yeah. Okay. After well, weeks. to be clear, this is where we're babies. My theater has a staff of zero. I work there voluntarily and do project to project work when we get grants. So we don't have a theater.
Okay.
We are working in partnership with an incredible, lovely company who also doesn't have a theater called Swallow a Bicycle Theater. Ooh. And with the Arts Commons, which is a big organization that has lots of theaters.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And the Arts Commons are providing us space for this because they believe they have, yeah, responsibility and accountability to like make space for new kinds of conversations and new art, which I'm super into, and I'm super into benefiting from that. Mm-hmm. So that is happening November 15th to 25th, and we might have some previews we might have some previews, like we might be open to the public as early as the 13th, but for sure we'll be open the 15th to 25th.
Okay. So, homework for me is to make sure that I get this episode produced and available to the public in time for people to know about your show and go see it if they can.
Cool.
We're recording this on August 22nd of 2018, and so far we have not yet released any episodes of The Context, and we're looking at an early October launch. So if you're hearing this, hopefully you're hearing this right around the middle to end of October, just in enough time to get your November 15th through 25th tickets for winners and losers at Chromatic Theater. And what's the work that you have before you now in order to get from I almost want to call it like a pilot program that you did in Toronto, even though it was a full production, but before it goes on to its mature iteration?
Lots of really fun spreadsheet work.
Yeah.
Some basics, because we did like a kind of light version in Toronto. I haven't worked with a designer, so hiring a designer and doing some of that work. It's a really simple design. It's a table, two chairs, a bell. But I learned a lot in Toronto about, again, the context, the playing field. I think a lot about, I'm trying to think a lot right now, but audience experience. And so, the theater space we're in Calgary is really different from the playing space we had in Toronto. And I'm trying to figure out how to keep the actors and the artists on the same level, which literally might mean physically.
Right.
Because there is some audience participation in terms of like, we'll ask the audience for topics and like the house lights don't really go down until the very end of the performance. Like the idea is that the audiences should feel invited to participate. And so the place we're going into, which has a raised stage, mm-hmm. I think I need a designer to think really about how we subvert all of the rules of the theatrical space so people feel like they can participate. And I mean, like, we've had wild participation that we didn't expect in Toronto, which was fantastic.
Tell us some examples, like you were just about to do.
Yeah. We did have a walkout, so I feel like we get a medal for that.
What?
Like
half the theater just like stood up and was like, no, bye?
Oh, no, just like a patron was like, I'm done with this.
Okay, that's really cool. That actually sounds way more encouraging than half the theater leaving, because that sounds like a problem. Okay.
We had people booing, people shouting out like answers or responses or like their own feelings without prompt, like
as though it were an improv show. But
yeah, I think like not real. I mean, our script, it's about 80% scripted, but mm-hmm. It's meant to feel live.
Okay.
It should feel live. You should see the show and then be like, what the hell was this lady talking about? It's clearly not scripted. Like literally having friends who I have told it's 80% scripted come and talk to me after the show being like, yeah, except for the show I saw was improvised.
I did the totally on the fly version because I knew you were coming. So I just told them not to use the script or any of the bullet points.
which is wild. But like, so there's like trivia sections, but like it's scripted, but then people being so invested in whoever they're cheering for that they're trying to shout out answers or they're trying to like not like they want to jump in. We had someone get up on stage and whisper a response in the actor's ear. Like booing, cheering. I think booing is like, it's just like a funny thing. It's not like the show was over and people were like, boo. It was like midway through an argument, someone just started booing someone.
Just like, that's a bad argument and I disrespect it with my voice now.
Yeah.
Cool.
Which is cool. You know, we had, we've had a lot of really interesting audience response, that has varied, widely. And I don't think that this is a play. I mean, go watch the one on the boards. I don't think that this is a play that is meant to make people walk away and be like, I loved it or I hated it. I think this is a play that's meant to make people walk away and go, what did I just see?
Uh-huh.
I did not agree with this. Why didn't I agree with this? I have questions about questions about questions about questions.
Yeah.
So it's meant to like make people go to the bar afterwards and talk to their friends.
I like that. And then do you have a way that you are facilitating those at the bar conversations, or a way to encourage people to do that secondary work? Or
yeah, not yet. I mean, Toronto, the development process always takes me longer than I think, and I should learn my lesson. But like, we were too raw to have that kind of conversation in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
So it's on the radar to at least do one, if not two or three post-show kind of conversations or talkbacks. Or maybe like you've just suggested, like maybe that's a brilliant idea I can take away and we can have an after the show at the bar night.
That's one of my favorite dramaturgy gigs. Follow me to the bar when the show's over.
yeah. Like I go, that's really cool. It's a tricky line because the performers are putting aspects of their real lives on stage. And so I also, as a dramaturg who, like when my dramaturg hat is on, I'm really protective of writers and their ideas and the things that we're trying to do. And if the thing you're trying to do is invite conversation, that's friggin' fantastic. But there's still ways for feedback to be given. And like, it's been tiny things where like, because so much of it is based on improvisations that we did, with hours and hours of improvisations that were then sent away to transcribed that we then got back and tried to like hang on the skeleton that we built dramaturgically. Like that's really the genesis of the play. There's meant to be a casual element, and the casual element is what allows people to feel that it's improvised. And the casual element is also imperfect because we are imperfect and the way that we speak is imperfect and we are not always politically correct. And, but when you're putting not the best version, if you're performing yourself and you don't get to put the best version of yourself out there, it's stressful.
Yeah.
And so when someone says like, I didn't usually, and it's like, it's not usually the, like, I didn't like this argument that's stressful. It's the like, I couldn't believe you used this word.
Oh, interesting.
That then
okay.
can be quite stressful on the performer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's a lot. That's a lot to process, a lot of responsibility, it sounds like, for you in connecting your audience with your artists in a way that's effective but sensitive. So you don't want to just leave everybody traumatized.
Gig for me to go to the bar and talk to everyone after, or like maybe have a round table or a long table with other art makers about the process, but not necessarily to throw the actors in the thick of it.
Yeah, I totally support that. Something else that I like the idea of, and it's something that theaters with a bigger staff can do, is to have these conversations after the show, like on social media, just be like, okay. And our, you know, our director, playwright, whoever is going to be on Twitter until, you know, midnight tonight. So if you're wondering about something after the show, or hop aboard the internet, and it kind of creates a good buffer. And I'm just kind of like thinking out loud about all the really innovative ways that I've seen dramaturgs and others sort of handle that communication piece when it is sensitive, and I've run stuff with performers and playwrights and actors where like I have not been super happy with not that I haven't been happy with the outcome, but I haven't been happy with how it leaves the artist's feeling afterwards, because it's a lot of emotional labor that maybe they didn't sign up for.
Totally. It's easier to, it's a funny thing to tease apart what's easier and what's more challenging to talk about, but it just is that some of it is easier to be like, well, at the end of this play, you should understand that we're making arguments and then counter arguments. And sometimes, you compromise your morals to be right.
Mm-hmm.
But I also find that like talking about women, talking about sisterhood, sometimes being right isn't always as important. That's controversial. I was going to say sometimes being right isn't always as important to women, but we hear that refrain all the time that like the woman is always right. But I think like sometimes when we fight with each other, like the tactics that we use are so different from men. Like sometimes if I want to be really mean, I'd be like, oh no, you're right. You're clearly better at that. Yeah, you like you're just you are the like you know you'll subvert yeah. it and try to give it to the other person so that you can win by being like diminutive or humble or
right.
sweet.
So the way that I win is that I'm the better person. I don't brag about stuff like you do. That's really interesting.
And you can see it play out. You can see it. Like, even I did it with my face. You said it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going, that's right. You are the better person. Like, you're so nice.
You're so good. I'm so happy for you.
I'm sure that people's spines are crawling. But I go, that is part of
it. But that's a thing. Yeah, it is.
And our play does end up kind of getting a little bit to that as it kind of reaches the boiling point about what is your agency?
Mm-hmm.
When to speak and not speak.
I want to see it. If any of our listeners want to give me a little Calgary scholarship, November 15th through 25th, just put a little money in my Venmo.
Yeah.
Buy a ticket. You can put money in your own Venmo. You can come with me, listener. If you're not a creep, let's go on a
date to Calgary. Chinook, which is different from global warming, though global warming is a thing and it's happening. That when Leonardo DiCaprio was in Calgary filming the Revenant,
yeah,
he was like global warming. It was like so warm here, but we were like, no, that's just a Chinook. It happens because we are on the side of a mountain and warm wind blows in winter and everything melts.
Well, that's actually really cool.
It's super cool, but also coming in November to Calgary is volunteering to hang out in snow. So
okay, I like
okay.
it.
Okay.
Cool. I mean, this has been so good. But we've been talking for some time.
Great.
So this is a lot to unpack, which I love, and I'm really interested to see when you're done with the next run, what the difference is in reception between your Toronto audiences and your Calgary audiences, and how you think that is informed by, you know, what changes you make versus who you have access to and who has access to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that you will keep me posted, even if what I'm able to do is just add a tag in our show notes, where are they now? Because you know, I'm invested in this process now.
Totally.
One question that I think I want to make sure going forward, I try to remember to ask everyone. Can you tell me, in the best words you have, what is dramaturgy?
Words are imperfect.
Yeah.
What is dramaturgy? For me, dramaturgy is the process of asking questions, of active questioning. In my work with writers, dramaturgy is also defending their story, the integrity of their story, holding them accountable to the things they want to say and tell. And like a little bit of like path making. Someone here in Calgary jokes that dramaturgy, this is the words of Carolyn Russell King, she jokes that dramaturgy is somewhere between a mechanic and a midwife. that I can help you bring your child into the world, and I can help with some technical fixes along the way.
I like that.
Yeah.
In my ideal editing world, that's going to go up at the top of the episode. But, you know, audience, hey, it's a new podcast, so I also want to say an audible caveat that, I don't know, maybe that won't end up happening. But I think that's so helpful to get a sense of how you do what you do. And I often feel like if we ask 100 dramaturgs what dramaturgy is, we're going to get maybe like 99 different answers, because like maybe two of them worked on a working definition together that they agreed on. Is there anything else that you want to make sure our listeners know about the work that you're doing, or the work at your theater, or who you are outside of your theatrical work before we go?
There's so many things.
I know, let's talk forever.
I know. I don't know that there's anything else necessarily that you need to know. Other than, like, I guess I do really believe fundamentally that, like, my work and my profession is about asking hard questions and is about creating conversation in some way, shape, or form. And I'm still learning, like, what that is. As I think that, as we started the show with the fact that work is never done, and I find that I am a kind of person who is really satisfied when work can't be completed, which is counter to my elementary, middle school self that really wanted to check every box and do all the things. But I've learned now in who I am that the really hard work is ongoing, and that is also the most satisfying.
Ooh, I like it. Jenna Rogers, everyone, you can learn more about, tell them where they can find you on the internet.
Chromatictheater.ca, and that's theater with an R-E.
America. The best way.
chromatictheater.ca is where you can find out more about me and my company. Yep.
Okay. Thanks so much for being with us here today, and hopefully we'll hear more about Winners and Losers and how winningful it was very soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today on the Context Podcast. You can learn more about our guest and the topics we covered today by heading to thecontextpod.com. That's thecontextpod.com. For exclusive bonus content, including monthly episodes and secret Spotify playlists and some other cool stuff, become a subscriber by going to patreon.com/thecontextpod. You can also follow along with our adventures on Twitter, where we are at ContextPod. And you can email us all your questions and episode ideas and thoughts and other things, just no dick pics, at thecontextpod@gmail.com. This episode of The Context was made possible by the 2018 Dramaturgy-Driven Grant from the Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas. Learn more about membership and how you could maybe get a grant for doing a thing you like at lmda.org/join. They don't require me to thank them, but it's a good group of folks, and I'm glad to be involved. They also don't require me to tell you that everything said on this podcast is my own opinion and not necessarily the views of LMDA, but that's also true. I don't think that LMDA would put dick pics in their closing bumper as a phrase to say. Anyway, that's all on me, not on them. Thanks for joining us.